Well, I am Gary, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Gary.
And it is really good to be here. You got no idea. I know I've said thank you before, but Larry, again, thanks for everything that happened, and thanks for the introduction. And it's just been a great weekend, and it's truly a privilege to do anything like this, but it seems a little more special this trip. My dry date is the third day of December, 1964. And that day pretty much started out with a cop dropping me off at the door to a nut house in Evanston, Wyoming. And just kind of keep that in mind, and we'll backtrack a little bit to tell you how that came about. I was raised on an experimental farm outside of Cheyenne, Wyoming. I was not the experiment. And I was just a kid growing up out in the country in a state that there's more people in some of the suburbs of Dallas than there is in the entire state of Wyoming, so it's not all cluttered up with folks. And so whenever I was around the crowd, whoever it was, whether it was the classroom or what it was as a kid growing up, I was a whole lot more comfortable out there in the grasslands that I was in any rooms where there were people. And that didn't seem to get better. Every once in a while something would go haywire in my life, and one of my parents or grandparents would say, well, he'll grow out of it. Well, I wasn't growing out of that stuff. It just it wouldn't happen. And just real briefly, my dad was an alcoholic, and he was a little guy. He was 5'6" tall, weighed about 125, 30 pounds, soaking wet, and had a small man's attitude. He was irritated a lot. And that's not a cheap shot, but it's true, that's all. And he just was. You couldn't trust him when he drank. You kind of knew what to expect when he wasn't drinking, because he'd be irritated. But when he was drinking, he could be the most fun person you'd ever met, as long as you didn't cross him. And so I learned when to cross and when not to till I got bigger than he was, and then it changed a little bit, not much. One day I asked him how my grandfather died on his side of the family. I'd run across a picture of my grandfather standing out in the grasslands in northeast Colorado. And he's got a flat brim hat on. He had a gun in his belt and his hands on his hips and a pint hanging out of his back pocket. And I remember looking at that picture. His name was Gay. That's when it was a name. And I said, how'd my grandpa Gay die? And my dad said, well, he died a natural death. And I said, how's that? And he said he was coming home one Saturday night, fell off the buckboard, and froze to death. And I never heard a different answer for that. I asked my aunt, and she wouldn't tell me. And so I assumed that was probably what happened to him. So I think probably my genealogy stayed pure time it got to me. I don't know, but I think so. I had a couple things going on. I did make it to school. My dad told me one time I had to finish high school no matter what. He said, because I didn't really like school at all and wanted to do other things. He said, no, you're going to finish high school even if we have to move into town so you don't have so far to walk when you get old. Be going to finish school. And so I just knew I had to do that as much as I disliked it. And I knew if I flunked out, he would make me go back. I just knew that was going to happen. And so I'd work a little bit to pass. Now, getting through school and doing the work wasn't the problem. Is I just hated going. It was so uncomfortable there for me, I just couldn't take it. It was awful. But I did finish right with the skin of my teeth some things were going on by then as it worked out. I relate to Tim a lot. I remember basketball interfering with my drinking, too. And I wanted to try out for basketball, but by the time the coach saw me, I'd been in trouble with booze and cigarettes, and so needless to say, I never made the team. And I remember being disappointed about that. I really was. I met a girl in high school. I had met lots of girls, and I really wished I could talk with them, because I'd watch the other guys do it, and it seemed like a good thing to do. I really wanted to, but I couldn't put that together either. I couldn't get the guts together to carry on much of a conversation or introduce myself to a new girl or do any of that. And so I guess when I was a junior and she was a sophomore, things had changed enough in my life that I could finally meet somebody. And I'll tell you a little bit about how that came about. As a sophomore in high school, I was hanging around with two other fellas, and we had decided to drive over to Laramie to the state basketball tournament. And when we got there, we found somebody to buy us a quart of Four Roses whiskey. And the two guys I was with went out and picked up two other girls to come with us. And we stopped and got some Coke, and we went out into the booth. That's Coca-Cola. Got to explain that anymore, Tim. You just can't go saying Coke. And they picked up a couple of girls, and we went out in the boondocks to do whatever we're going to do. I thought about that long after I got sober. We had the girls in the car, and we had the whiskey in the car, and we didn't know what to do with either one back then. But they passed the bottle around that first time, and I did it right. You know, I took a slug of it and wipe it off. You got to do that first. You take it and you pass it on. Forgot about the Coke. And then the second time I came around, I tipped it up, and I kept it up until I took it away from me. And everything changed. Everything changed. What I learned right then, that I had needed a drink for 16 years. I mean, I needed it. And that was exactly what I needed. And everything changed. I mean, it just did. I don't know. In other words, I felt great in the car. I made a grab for one of the girls, and it was unsuccessful, but it was. I made the grab. I hadn't done that. And apparently I was getting out of hand, and they were going to sober me up, and took me to the truck stop to fill me full of coffee, and at the truck stop I took a poke at a cowboy, and you think that girl slapped me around, you didn't see anything after I hit him. And God, it was just the greatest night of my life. It was just super. It just was. I'd done all those things I hadn't had guts enough to do. I always did want to smack a cowboy. I grew up around him all the time. And then there was one I grew up around who used to whip my butt every Saturday just because he could. And man, I just wanted to get the first lick in, and I did. Didn't work, but that was just it. Every drink I took after that, I was chasing that feeling. I don't think I ever took a drink, but what I wanted to feel like I did that night in Laramie. And I don't remember ever taking a drink just to be sociable, and it doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense to me now. I met the girl in high school then that I could finally talk to, and I'm still talking to her. This August we'll be married 50 years. There's been any number of times out for bad behavior for me. I was telling Tim earlier, the difference between he and I is we never divorced. And we dated all through high school. Went in the Army for 6 months in a court martial, and got out, and she was still in high school. And the day I got out, I called the high school, and I told the people in the office that I was her dad, and there was an emergency in the family, and I was going to go by the north door of the school to pick her up. And she went out there really concerned that something was bad wrong, and she saw me, and so. That's kind of how we started out. The following September, we ended up getting married, and the following January, we had our first daughter. She was an 8.5-pound preemie. Now, some of you guys are old enough to hear that. You say that anymore, and what are you talking about? No, I'll tell that with my wife in the room. You can watch her lips move saying, "You son of a bitch." And the whole time I'm drinking, I still couldn't do anything but drink. From the time that 16 years old, and I hit that nut house December 3rd of 64, and that was a month before my 25th birthday. And at that point in time, we had three little girls. The youngest one was born that previous August. And I knew she was there, but I couldn't picture in my mind. I didn't know what she looked like. And I'd been drinking that hard and heavy. The day that cop dropped me off at the nut house, I was I was 6 foot 2 inches tall, but I weighed something less than 130 pounds, and I'd taken any number of beatings. And when I went in the door, they asked me if I'd come in to take part in their alcoholic rehabilitation program. To this day, I don't know how they knew. And that started a process that hopefully is still going, I guess, if you will. The normal tour for an alcoholic in the Wyoming State Hospital at that point in time was a 16-week session. Couldn't really call it a spin dry. And they kept me locked in a room with a little glass window in it. That's the only place to see out. And I didn't see out much unless I look up there and there'd be people seeing in. They'd have their nose pressed up against the glass. Looked funnier than him. And I learned to eat in there. And they finally let me out and put me on the alcoholic ward. And I found out I was the youngest guy in the ward. By pretty good ways. And it was that had a whole lot to do with it. I got to tell you that. When they talked about their alcoholism and when they talked about the times they wanted to stop drinking and absolutely could not, and the times they had told their boss or their wife or whoever it was that they were going to stop drinking, they had really meant it. And I had done all those things. There was never a time that I said that I was lying. I just meant it. And there was never a time that I said that I was able to do it. I was powerless and it wouldn't happen for me. I learned I was an alcoholic there, the same way many of us still do, and probably with the same old U-shaped gelatinic chart you see in jitter joints, you know. The various stages of alcoholism as you go down the chart on one side and the supposed various stages of recovery as you go back up on the other side. But I just remember kind of checking them off to get down to the mess at the bottom with the DTs and the convulsions and nut houses and all those things it talks about. So I could go all the way down. It seemed to me, and still does, that while obviously you probably wouldn't have found any booze in my system after just a few weeks in there, or even after I got out, I'm sure it was gone. But as I look back over those, whatever it was, weeks, months, maybe first couple of years, it's really foggy. You know, who is it that talked about it being ambulatory after 6 weeks? I think it's Hightower or something like that. But I really think that happened to me. It just took me the longest time to snap out of it. If it has yet. I won a free ride to college. They came to me in that nut house the week or so I was supposed to leave. And they said, "Gary, did you know that there's a deal out there where if you want to, you can attend college at the University of Wyoming, we'll buy all your books, pay all your tuition, and give you enough money to maintain your life with your wife and your children. You have to understand that the alternative was I had to go look for a job." And so obviously I decided I'd go to school. And as much as I didn't like that idea. And so we ended up in Laramie and at the University of Wyoming. And I had to go through 4 years of college and 3 years in the summer, and did. I took a four-year degree and 3 years in the summer because I didn't dare take any time off because I had to be with me. At this point in time, well, let's just take that further. I finished that 3 years in the summer. I hadn't taken a drink, but I was still suffering from untreated alcoholism. The only way I'd even started getting close to the treatment was attending some AA meetings. And let me tell you about an AA meeting in Laramie, Wyoming at that point in time, back in the late 60s. The only group met up over a drugstore in what used to be an old dentist's office. And you get dust in Laramie about like you get dust in Texas. And you'd go in there and the dust would have blown in, and I would get there early and take my books down to that meeting and make coffee. I made a 30-cup pot of coffee for five alcoholics. Very often none of them would show up. I tried to drink the whole thing. I wonder if I got my own kidneys. But I would sit there sometimes and make that coffee and try to study. And that thing would be going on in here, several people have mentioned it, the hole in their belly with the wind blowing through. And this is nearly 4 years sober that's doing it. And I'd look out the window across the street at the Buffalo Bar. Had a flashing neon sign that said Buffalo. Buffalo. B was out. Actually, it said Buffalo. Buffalo. And I would sit there and I'd look at that and my knuckles would be turning white and I'd say, God, don't let me take a drink. Don't let me go in and take a drink. I really don't want a drink. And I spent an awful lot of time that first 4 years sober thinking just like that. I had one friend at that AA meeting that was about my age, but he didn't have an alcohol problem. They were letting him come to meeting because he just got back from prison for some things he was smuggling in from Mexico, and I don't know what all it was. And there was no boy that was talking one time, his name was Frank, and he'd come into that meeting and he'd say, I think this time the reason I'm sober, because he'd been in and out a lot, is I took the third step this time. I'd never done that before, and I've been sober. He says, well, I'm sure it's the third step, it's the answer. And the following Saturday, old Frank came down drunk, and I thought, man, I'm not screwing with that third step. That's all I knew about it. You know, if you don't swallow, you won't get drunk. Now, that's not much AA, is it? I understood at some level that I was absolutely powerless overtaking the first drink. I just knew that. And I don't, to this day, I don't know why I didn't. I really don't. It just had to be God's gift, and it was. Because there wasn't a day in there that the hole in the belly, with the wind blowing through it, wasn't going on. Every day it was at least as bad as the day's drinking. I would think at times later on when I'd move to Denver, the people would talk about not trading their best day drunk for their worst day sober. And I thought, that don't sound like too bad a deal to me. Maybe I ought to jump at that. Finished school, ended up in Denver, and through a series of things, scrambled to some meetings. And I'd never been any place where there was more than two meetings a week until I got down to Denver. And so I would scramble to some meetings, and I found a meeting where another young guy showed up. I hadn't attended any meetings where a young guy showed up before. And I'd heard this remark some people say that I think they were good people and wanted to say something, but they said, gee, we wish we'd have got a hold of this thing at the same age you are when you come in now. Wouldn't have to go through all the shit I went through. And I'd sit there and think, well, I just finished damn near dying. I don't have a whole lot to go through. I don't think I got another one left. And I started to feel like I couldn't fit in Alcoholics Anonymous again. Now, that was my fault for feeling that way, because I think those people meant well, looking back on it. But it used to irritate the hell out of me. And another guy came into that group that was my age, and we started hanging out together. And so what we would do, we'd take a big book into the coffee shop, and we thought the first portion of the fifth chapter needed rewriting. And so we would try that, and then we'd bellyache about life and bellyache about AA. And one day we're at his house doing that when his wife throws us out of the house. She said we're the two most miserable so-and-sos she'd ever met, and we had to get out of their house. And she says, try a different meeting. Something ain't working for you two. How'd she know? And so my friend Joe gets all puffed up. He says, all right. He says, Brown, let's go down to that young people's group we've heard about. He says, the babes there got to be better looking anyway. And obviously he and Janet are not married anymore. But we did. We went down to the young people's group that night. Joe was right. They were better looking at the young people. And I heard AA I hadn't heard before. And you know, I'm approaching 4 years sober. I heard AA talked about, they talked about what the big book said and doing what it said. I had never heard that before. And no one ever said that to me, that I heard. And so it was new. But I had been sober longer than most of those people, and I figured I was there to tell them how the cow ate the cabbage, and they weren't listening. Thank God. They were listening. And some things happened there in the group. We had a lot going on back then that I wasn't aware about. About a year before I moved down there, I'd attended the state, the Wyoming State AA Convention in Cheyenne. And at this time, I'm irritated because of all the people and being the only young person in there and feeling like, and I was looking back on it now, I felt like the third tradition is being used against me, because invariably there'd be some old geezer come up to me and say he'd spilled more on his tie than I drank. And I learned a two-word answer for that. There's not a better one if you figure out what it is. And and so, you know, I felt picked on about these guys and all that. But I got to tell you, I went into this convention one day, and there was three younger AAs standing there. And I swear to you, to this day, I looked at them, and I thought to myself, I wonder what these punks want. Exactly what I thought. But they came to recruit people to go to Denver to the International Young People's Convention that was being held down there in 67. And I couldn't go because I had to finish college to take finals or something, but I couldn't go, and I never went. But when I got down there in 68, I met those same three guys. I'm still friends with one of them. The other two have gone, and they died sober because of their activity in AA. Went to the young people's group, and they talked about forming another meeting to go through the big book and talk steps. We knew, get a little ahead of myself there, we knew that the answer was in the book and the steps. But mostly we knew it was in the steps. And I was at the place where, looking at the steps, I had to find the easiest way to do the steps. And I did. I tried my best. I tried any guide to inventory was out there. One of them was from Hazelden. And I tried looking at the 12 and 12, and I tried looking at the big book, and the 12 and 12 seemed easier. And so I tried doing what the 12 and 12 said. And I tried reading the Hazelden Guide to Inventory. I read a few pages, and it told me that I was probably going too fast. Maybe I needed to put it down and take a break. I started that break about 40 years ago, and I haven't finished it yet because I haven't picked that up yet again. And like I say, I tried to go into the steps the easiest way I could. I wasn't listening to anybody else, I don't think. I don't know what's going on. So anyway, we finally got started in the big book, and the things were going on, and my lives changed. During the reading of the doctor's opinion, I understood all of it, and I related to every bit of it. There wasn't a thing in there I didn't relate to. And we moved on into the book, into the more about alcoholism. We came to the line there that on the first page it says, we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step to recovering. The delusion where anything like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. And I can't tell you why or what happened. I remember reading it that night, and I remember all of a sudden feeling like I had been given the keys to the kingdom. And I somehow began to understand that effectively what I know now is pages 23 through 43 in the big book have to do with the unmanageable life. You know? If we didn't take the first drink, this wouldn't be an issue. The whole rest of the issues, we can't keep from taking the first drink. I can't. With that. And so I'm starting to gather this information, and things are starting to change for me. And we start going to more meetings, and we started a group there to go through the book, the Denver Young People did. We had a bunch of men and women that were going to start a third meeting of the Young People's Group, and it was going to be this big book thing where we're going to go through and try and do what it says. And got to tell you, by the time, well, I'll just tell you, we read through what I was just talking about. I had that immense change. We got into the fourth chapter that you read tonight, and some conversation going on was about coming to believe. Now, I wasn't struggling so much with the concept of God. I didn't have one then. I'm not sure I have one now, but I have a God. But I'm not going to try to conceive what he looks like, how he acts, or anything else. I just know he's going to love me and take care of me, and I don't want to take it beyond that. If not, it's like Mike said today, I become God if I think I know what he is. Anyway, talking about the second step, I'm coming to believe, and I can tell you how I came to believe. I've been going to AA meetings that now easily 4 years. I've been watching people come into AA and their lives changing. Now, they were going to the same places I was going, doing the same things they were doing, but their lives were changing. And I mean it. They were all of a sudden holding jobs. They were paying their bills. They were getting caught up on their child support. They were doing all that stuff. They're keeping their checkbook straight. I couldn't do that. You know, I was still stretching checks at a long time sober. I'd watch them do it, and it just kind of had to be a God doing it. Something was changing. It's clear to me. One of my friends' name is Tom. And I think he lives somewhere in Dallas now, but I haven't heard from him for years. And Tom was probably the man I had the most fun with in AA early back those years. He was crazy, and I just loved being around him. But he was at the Young People's Group one night talking about the time he'd been sent to a high-dollar psychiatric center. It's called Mount Airy. Not a great name for the airheads. And they had the aversion treatment going on then. And some of you people here know what that is. Those that don't, it's a medieval treatment where the hospital had just had their alcoholic ward there, and they had the treatment room in the ward, and the room was just a room. Just picture a room maybe 15 feet square with mirrored walls and shelves on the mirrors and liquor on the shelves. In the middle of the room is a what looks like a barber chair on one arm is a stainless steel pot that'll swivel in front of whoever's in the chair and away from him. And they'd given Tom some man abuse, and they put him in the chair, and they pointed at the wall and said he could have anything he wanted to drink. And of course he did, and he drank on the abuse, and he got violently ill. And in the mirrors, he can watch himself, you know, he can watch himself puking, and his eyebrows falling out, and his toenails curling, and all that. Whole idea of that treatment is, after that treatment, you're going to be as adverse to it, you're never going to take another drink. And I'll never forget. Tom said that night that it worked. It had really worked. He said he hadn't had reason or excuse to take an abuse since. And Tom's life was changing, and I watched him. And I came to believe that there was a power greater myself that would help me, that would restore me to sanity. And I began to understand that the restoring to sanity that the book was talking about there has to do with what I was just talking about with that first and second step. I think we did the most insane things we did as alcoholics, stone sober. I did. Took the first drink. I took the first drink many times, having knowledge of how I had behaved before, what had happened when I drank. Couldn't predict what I was going to do. Couldn't be predicting who I was going to smack, was I going to go to jail, were the kids going to be all right, was Julie going to be all right. You couldn't do it. No idea. And I'd take that first drink anyway. Now that's nuts. And that's what the second step was talking about. I made that statement in Louisville one time. Tim, and I don't know if you ever knew Carter Redding, did you? And Carter came up to me afterwards, and he said, "Don't you think maybe somehow in that second step it means we can be restored to wholeness?" And I had to concede that he's probably right, but I didn't tell him that. But we were at this point in that group going through the steps down to 14 men. And I don't know what happened to the girls. I don't think I chased them off, but they had all disappeared. We're 14 guys, and we're going through the book, and we're serious, and we get through the first portion of the fifth chapter. I'll never forget the discussion we had there that one night that we're talking about letting go of our old ideas, and we discovered that meant all of our old ideas, not just our bad old ideas. It's all my old ideas. My very best old ideas got me in the nut house. They got to go. They just do. And we were sitting in the room, and one of the little guys in the room was talking about, we're reading about the actor and the third step showing up there, and he said he had an idea. He said he thought maybe that the 14 of us should read and hold hands, read and slash pray that prayer together. Said he wanted to do that because he'd been to a number of meetings recently, and they were all four-step meetings. And after the meetings, he had gone up to a few people and asked them why they hadn't written an inventory. And some of them said because they hadn't taken the third step yet. And so Lee wanted us all to take the third step together, because if a few weeks later we would hear him telling somebody he hadn't started to write because he hadn't taken the third step, we could call him a damn liar because we heard him do it. And we understood that kind of logic. And so we did that. And I remember sitting there and getting in that circle with those guys and holding those hands and feeling stupid as hell and saying that prayer. And I was doing it because they were. I wasn't about to step out of the circle. I'm sure they wouldn't have cared if I hadn't. But I did it because they did it, I know. And then on the way home, I have got all this sensation going on in me and all these feelings moving about, and I told God that I really meant that prayer. Please make it real, God. I can't stand this any longer. I don't know how much longer I can do this. The 14 men in that group, kind of give you some history. You've met some of them here, some of you guys that were there, but we lost one. Within a couple of weeks after that, Eddie Durkin went out and drank, and they found him froze to death in a doorway. But the rest of us are either still sober or have died sober. And one of that group, as trustee at large, took AA into Russia. And many of that group, and there's two of us still out on the circuit doing stuff and sharing our experience. Jay took big steps in carrying the AA message into the Jewish community in Denver. And there's guys in there that he helped out that they're 30-plus years sober now from all of this. And a wide range of things came out of that group, and it happened. I just want to tell you that. Don and I used to talk about, why did that happen to us in this group? What did it do? And we don't know the answer to that. We were just a bunch of young punks who really didn't know anything other than the answer is here. And if you don't get anything else, get this and do precisely what it says. And based on my experience, you don't have to trust in anything else. This is enough to do it. I meant we had to write inventory, of course. And so I was stalling, and I know nobody here does that, but I was stalling, didn't want to do it. And one of the guys in the group, in fact, I told you about some of you about him this afternoon, had disappeared. I didn't like him anyway, and I'd go to the digs. I mean, I'd go to the young people's meeting, and people would say, "Where's Ernie?" And I said, "Don't knock it, he's gone." And he came back after a couple of weeks, and he came into the room, and I remember looking at him, and there was something different about him. And I've described it before, and I haven't found a better way to do it. When I looked at him that Tuesday night, there was somebody home when I looked him in the eye. and there hadn't been anybody there before. And it changed something. And when it came his time to talk, he talked about getting into a beef with his wife and running away to Lake Whitney, Texas, and hooking up with Bob White, who stuck him in one of the cabins down on the lake and gave him a pad, a pencil, and a big book and showed him how to write inventory. What Bob did not do is go write an inventory without showing him how. That ain't fair to kick one of us in the butt and give us a book and say, go do it, when we're at that point in our lives, probably can read the big book and not have a clue what it just said. That was my experience. It just went right over my head. But anyway, Ernie sat down there and he wrote his inventory, and he came out and went up to the big house and told Bob he's done. And Bob knew that Ernie really liked to fish. And so he said, grab some of them poles and let's go out in the big boat and get out in the middle of the lake. They get out in the middle of the lake, and Bob turns the boat off and turns to Ernie and he says, tell me what's in that inventory. And Ernie can't swim, so he took a fist step. And something had clearly changed in Ernie when I saw him at the meeting at that too. And that's all he'd done. And I got to tell you, I went home that night and I started my inventory. And as inventories go, it was probably lousy. At that point in time, I had opened the big book up and all I had looked at was a three-column example, which means I was missing a lot of the really important stuff, would you agree? And it was a lousy inventory, and the only thing it did was save my life. That's just all it did. And I took my fifth step with Ernie. The guy hadn't lied. And that was the beginning of things to start changing for me. I had been fired from my job and was looking for a job and didn't know what to do. I remember trying to tell the people that were firing me from my job that I'd just done all this work in AA and I had taken this fist up and all that. They said, get out of here, you're not doing the job. So I was recruited into a business I wouldn't have picked for all the money in the world. It's been the last thing on my list to do. It was straight commission, and I was too terrified to do that. I didn't have enough trust in God to take care of that. And but that was the only thing that I could get. Nothing else was showing up. And it turned out I was good at it. In a short time, I was a 50% partner in the business. And then a short time after that, things started happening in our lives, and it's time to move on. And so I gave my half of the business to my partner, and Julie and I moved to Indianapolis. I've cut out some of the drama there, but that's the bottom line. We moved to Indianapolis as a result of a prayer. And the next morning, some of the old-timers know who it was. My wife and I had said a prayer the night before that we didn't know what was going to happen or what to do, but it was time to do something different. And we went to bed and gone to sleep, and my foot hadn't hit the floor next morning, and I get a phone call from Don Roy. You remember Don, Larry? And he says, I'm not sure why I'm calling you. He says, I'm sitting here in my quiet time, and you just came to mind, and I called you. And so he offered me a job to come to somewhere in the Midwest and go to work for him, selling advertising to car dealers and banks and stuff like that, and radio production. And Julie and I thought about that for maybe 30 seconds. I think the question was, do you really think that was from God? And the answer was, it sure beats a bolt of lightning. And so we get to Indianapolis, and at that point in time, back in 1977, Indianapolis only had about 50 AA meetings in the city. Population maybe 500,000, 600,000. And most of them were speaker meetings. There were very few discussion meetings. Not that that's bad. But what that meant is the new guy in town that was willing to shoot off his mouth ended up talking at all 50 meetings before pretty short order. And I was telling my story about going through the steps up to this far. But I couldn't get any takers to do it with me. I really kept saying somebody's going to do it, and it happened. And it took me 3 years. And I think I wore them out. when a guy that had come in that was still my favorite redneck of them all, he was nasty. And he's one of those guys that sit in the gold brick bar and they'd have contests and who could hold the burnt cigarette on their arm the longest. You know, really great, really intelligent, bright guy. And he came calling me one day. He says, "I want to start one of the meetings, taking the people through steps like that." And I said, "Great, glad to hear it." He says, "It's going to be at my house on Wednesday." I said, "Great, start next Wednesday, 8 o'clock." I said, "Great." He says, "You'll come, won't you?" And I said, "Sure." And so we did. We went over that. And the interesting thing, we had 14 men there. And we lost one, and I hope he didn't go freeze to death. We never saw him again. But from that one, after the first one was done, the men in there, including me, had such a great experience. They went out in ones and twos and started doing the same thing we had just done and getting some more people to do it with that. And then later on, some girls got to doing it. And today, you could go to the Indianapolis metropolitan area, I don't know what to guess. I think if Mike and I were to really put the pencil to it and trying to find out how many of those kind of workshops are going on any given week, we'd probably find around 20, 25 of them around there. It just caught on, and people's lives gets changed, and it's worked. It's working real good for everybody except me, because I was pulling a punch. I was pulling a big punch. I had stopped at the point I just told you about. Every time I take people through the work and the steps, I did the steps with them. I wrote lots of inventories, and they were good inventories, a lot better than that first one, but they weren't saving my butt like the first one. Because I kept pulling a punch. The way life was going for me is I'd get done with the fourth and the fifth step, and I'd feel good. And I'd get back out there, and then life would go back down. And it'd get bad enough like that go right into the inventory, take fifth step, feel good for a while. And the problem is the highs got lower and the lows got deeper every time I did that. And so I reached to a point where I talked about some of my lying, cheating, and stealing this afternoon, but I was in trouble. I was in trouble. I was financially. I was losing Julie and the girls. And I was losing my friends in AA because they knew how I was behaving. I wasn't hanging around home. And I was writing bad checks, and I was doing all that stuff. And it got so bad one day that I called Paul, who's my current sponsor. I said, "Paul, is there any possibility that a 40-some-year-old alcoholic grandfather with 20 years of sobriety could be going through male menopause?" And he said, "Well, maybe. He said, "Why don't you go through the steps again, review your first step, take another third step, write another inventory, and come up here and take some fifth steps." And I said, "I'll do whatever you want." And I got to tell you, I was more desperate at that point at 20 years sobriety than I'd ever been in my life. Much more desperate than when I first came in. And so I did. And by the end of that week, I had finished my inventory. And I got to tell you about that inventory. The resentment list was all current stuff. I was not going over anything that I'd been over before. And what that tells you is, stone sober, I can cause as much harm as I ever did drinking. And the fear inventory was current stuff. And the sex inventory, I went all the way back and did it completely over. And I did it right this time. For each one of those gals I could think of, I asked the 9 questions in the inventory. And I found it out. And so I called Paul on a Thursday, and he says, "You need to be up here tomorrow." Gave me the name of a motel out in LaGrange and told me to be there by 4 o'clock. And I did. And I got up there, and I was a little bit early, so I ran across the street to the convenience store, got a cup of coffee, and I came back. There's a knock on the door. And I opened the door, and there's a guy there I'd never seen before, but he tells me his name is Dennis O'Brien, and he's 29 years sober. And he's there to take a fifth step with me, We're going to swap fist steps, he said. And he walks in carrying a ring binder like the one I was carrying, and he said, I'll go first so you know what to do. And he sits down, and he reads the inventory to me. And then I sit down, and I read my inventory to him. A lot of similar stuff there. He was a long-time sober. He'd done the same stuff I had. And we compared some notes. I'd picked up some things he'd missed. He picked up some things I had missed. And he got up and left. And I run down to that convenience store and get back with a cup of coffee, and there's another knock on the door. And this guy's name is Chuck. And he's there to swap fifth steps, and he's going to go first, so I'll know what to do. And I did that 9 times by noon Sunday. And at that point in Paul would have been, 41 years sober. And down to some guys that were 2 or 3 years sober. And all that. And I couldn't pull rank on them because they'd done more in the steps than I had. Couldn't pull any seniority at all. Didn't mean a thing. And we go to lunch there on that Sunday before I go home. And there was only 3 or 4 of them at this point and myself. And they told me to take my pad and pencil out again, and they were going to help me with my amends list. And they had really good memories. And particularly what they'd heard in there. And then Paul said, now what about those amends you owe that didn't show up in this inventory? Now obviously he had dealt with people like me before to ask that question, if you think about it. And there were several, and I owed a lot of money. I had borrowed money, stolen money, whatever I could do for years. And we just owed a lot of money. It wasn't that we had anything for it. It's not like there was new houses, new cars, new furniture. We just owed it. And I just owed it. And so we tried to put together that list as best we could at that point, off the top of my head. And I found some more after I left. But I went home and I sat down with Julie and my wife, and we discussed that. And I said, it just means you and the girls are going to have to suffer that much more, because I really have to pay these all back. And she had gone with me many times to borrow money from my parents, her parents, Dial Finance, wherever the hell we went to get it. And she decided those amends were as much hers as mine. And so we agreed at that point that we were going to sit down and get those taken care of, but we had to start somewhere. And so on Tuesday night, we started on the list, and we called Julie's folks as a place to start. And it seemed like that might be a little easier, but not necessarily. The relationship I had with Julie's mother was not a comfortable relationship. My name was never on anything from that house in Cheyenne to our house with my name as on the address. It was always Julie Brown, and I was on the phone. She just says, Julie there. She wouldn't listen to the how are you or anything else. So I called her, and fortunately, Julie's dad answered the phone. And I told him why I was calling. I told him as much as I could at that point in time that I was calling because some way, somehow, my life had to straighten out. I was going to die drunk. I said, I can't continue to live the way I've been doing it. And so part of that is for me to try to clean some things up. And I told him, I said, I owe you one lot of money, but I think more importantly, I owe you a thanks and a consideration you never got. Because I don't remember him ever getting angry with me all those years. And I told him that I knew I had worried him sick with the way I treated his daughter and his granddaughter. And I said, and you were always kind and tolerant to me. And I don't remember you ever saying anything to me. And then I said, I love you. And that was the wrong thing to say. Because he said, oh, shit. And he gave the phone to Grandma. So I go through the same thing with Julie's mom. And then I finally get to the point, and I says, have you any idea how much money you've given us over the years? And she said, right down to the last penny. So So we made a deal to start making some kind of payments that probably didn't amount to anything more than tokenism. Excuse me. But we started it there. And we started making the other calls. One was to a guy who, going to college, had given me a part-time job. He owned a men's shop there. And he trusted me in there. I was the oldest student that worked for him at that men's shop. So often, I would be the one that he would ask to stay and close up. And if he could go to the country club or go out and go elk hunting or something, and I could manage the store and close it up. And there were any number of nights I let some of the guys go home early so that way I could go on and try on the clothes I was going to steal for the night. And I left Laramie one of the better dressed graduating seniors to come out of there, but I hadn't paid for any of the clothes. And so I had to track this guy down, and I was going to AA then, and he knew it. So I had to find John. He'd retired and sold the store, and I get a hold of him finally, and I said, "This is Gary Brown. Do you remember me?" He says, "Yeah, of course I do." He said, "Are you still going to those meetings?" I said, "Yeah, that's why I'm calling." So I told him about stealing the clothes, and we make arrangements to pay it back. We kind of had to figure it back and forth to come up with how much it would have come to based on those dollars. Started making payments to him, and they didn't amount to much more than tokenism, but that's all I could do. And there were a number of other calls there. And so how it would work then at that point in time, I'd get a payday, or Julia would get a payday, and I'd go upstairs and I'd look at this columnar pad I had that 18 columns across and had as many of those things listed up there, plus current debts that you had to take care of, you know, lights and gas and house payment. And I had doing this, but the way it would work is I'd take my check out, and I'd pay down there and go across. If they got paid last payday, we skipped that and went up here, and we go down till we're down to just enough money for groceries and gas and what do the kids need for school, and we're busted till the next payday. And that's the way it was every week. We do that. And then one day I came downstairs and really feeling bad. And I told Julie, I says, "I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't think I have the capability of earning the kind of income it takes to pay this back. I don't have that kind of ability to earn money. I don't understand how it's going to happen." I was just stumped. And I was looking for the sympathy, and I'll tell you, that was a wrong damn woman to do that with. But the next morning, we were downstairs having breakfast, and she said she had an idea. Now, that should have told me something. But her idea was that I had had the same job for a number of years, longer than I'd ever worked anywhere in my life. That still might be true. But at that time, and I had a 401k that had more money in it than we ever dreamed we'd have in savings. And we lived in that same house, I think, for 11 years, so it had equity. That's unheard of these days. Back then, we had equity. She says we could sell the house, cash in all our retirement, and pay off all those amends, and pay off the current debt, and maybe there'd be enough money for us to buy a used trailer house to live in. And I think, oh, hell, she can't be serious. Which I knew she was. And I went to work. I didn't want to think about that. And I come home that night, and I said I had an idea. I said, "Let's call Paul and see what he says," because I was sure he had a way out of that. And so I did, and I call him, and I go through the routine. You know, I tell him about selling the house, doing all that. And I said, "How local does that sound?" He says, "Gary, I've known you for 20 years. That's the sanest thing I've ever heard you say." He said, "Was it your idea?" And I said, "No, it was Julie's," and he said he thought so. So we cleaned up the house and listed it for sale, and made that call in September. The house sold on February 28th, and I remember that date because it was Julie's birthday. And she was 39 again. In fact, she had another 39th birthday a couple weeks ago. It was probably the greatest days of our lives as a married couple, because the money was there, We got it paid off. What I didn't tell you in there that happened was that Tuesday we called Julie's dad and made the amends to him. The following Thursday, he was out trying out his new snowmobile and had a stroke and never regained consciousness. That's close, isn't it? Wouldn't that have been a shame to not have that clean when he got what he wanted? Another thing I didn't tell you is I made that deal with John at the clothing store to pay him $50 a month to start paying that off. At $50 a month, I'd still be paying it. It's big, that big a number. And I'd paid him for a while, and then I missed a commission check. And he didn't get paid, and he called me wanting his money. And I told him that I just missed a commission check, but I had to pay that off, that he'd get it back, and we'd get caught up on it. And I was stone serious, and I knew I would. And he said, no, he said, I think I don't need that money. He said, but you got to promise me you'll take care of the rest of it. And I said, okay, so I did. He forgave me the money. And so flash forward to the day that we cash in all that stuff and sold the house. And I am, in my mind, trying to figure out how I'm going to tell Paul, my sponsor, that didn't have to pay the clothing store owner back because he forgave me the money. You never talked to my sponsor if you thought that I was going to get away with that. And I wasn't about to try it. So I called Laramie again and I said to John, what's your address? I got the money to pay you back right now. And he gave me the money, gave me the address. He forgot he forgave me. And I gave him the money. Back in there, when I was in so much trouble, and that I'd got to know a guy on that I'd spoken with on the circuit a couple of times and done some things, and he lives up in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and he used to make an awful lot of money, and he just had this wonderful business going. But one day he called. He was talking in Virginia or someplace, and said, I decided I'd leave a day early and stop at Indianapolis and see you and Julie on my way down there. And I said, great, I'd love to see you. Pick him up at the airport. We stop and have a cup of coffee, and he looks at me. He looks me in the eye. He says, what the hell is the matter? He says, you look like hell. And I says, well, I'm terrified. I said, they're going to foreclose on the house tomorrow morning, and my wife doesn't know it, and I'm afraid it'll kill her. And he said, he didn't say anything. I hadn't told anybody. I hadn't told any of my buddies in AA that. I hadn't said a word to anybody about that. I hadn't been living with it. We're in the car, we're driving out to the house, we're driving past downtown on the interstate, when he says, where's your bank? I said, what bank? He says, the one that has a note on your house. I said, it's right downtown here. He says, let's go see him and have a talk with him. I said, Bob, they really don't want any talk. They're tired of talk. So let's go see anyway. So I'll never forget it. We had to park across the street from the bank, and we're jaywalking, go over to the bank, and I felt like I was walking in to see the principal with my dad, you know. We go in there, and we get down there, and a very angry banker comes in with a file folder about that high. And he sits down there, and I'm sitting in the guest chair, and Bob's right up against the desk. And Bob says, what's it take to get Gary caught up? The banker's attitude changed right quick, and he looked up the number, and it was a big number. I was months behind on that, and had never told you. Bob reached in his pocket, and he's carrying a roll of cash and driver's check, and he peeled off several thousand dollars. And we're walking out of there, and I'm stunned. I don't know if I've ever been more stunned in my life, drunk or sober. We're going across the street. I said, Bob, I got to pay that back. And he said, that's your problem. I still don't think he was that bright to think of that, how right he was there. But he was really right about that. So now flash forward, and we sold the house and cashed in our retirement. And I called Bob, and I said, give me your address. I'm in shape to pay back that money you gave me all those years ago. And he laughed. And I said, what's so funny? And he says, well, cowboys like this. He said, back then when I gave you that money, I had a business that generated cash faster than we could spend. And my wife and I were always looking for a place to tithe. We were always looking for somebody else. You could only give so much to the church. You could only give so much to the clubhouse. And so as he would travel the country talking and all that, they had agreed that they would look for the people they felt was an answer to their prayer on what to do with the money. And he says, it wasn't just you. We helped out several people around the country. And he said, Congress has changed your laws. And I can no longer take advantage of accelerated depreciation on my investments. And we can't syndicate any more apartment houses or oil wells or exotic cattle or anything anymore, and he can't do that. And he said, we are trying to get by on just rents, and I got investors mad at me, and I'm on a budget. An allowance is the term he used for the first time in his life. And he says, I stay on top. I don't talk about this in the podium, but I talk to my sponsor about it every day just to make sure I'm staying honest on it. It's not a good day, don't it? And he says, three or four times a week, I'll walk down to the post office to get the mail. And just about every week now, you know, a check shows up, and I haven't asked anybody for the money. I have not asked anybody to pay me back. All I knew at that point was I owed him several thousand dollars, and I was probably writing a check while he was telling me that, if I hadn't already. And then I realized a little later just how big a deal that was and how big a deal this is. I think the biggest deal in Alcoholics Anonymous happens in our home groups. Or it happens one-on-one when we're sitting over as sponsor and sponsee, doesn't matter which one is which, and you're having a cup of coffee. Particularly if you're going through the book and the steps instead of making up the program as you go along. Things are going to change and somebody's life's going to change, and hopefully it's both of you. My experience since that time, I got to tell you something I did. I just thought of this today when we were sitting there. I'm going to quit here in a minute so you can get a nap before breakfast. I want you to all be able to stay awake for Mike's talk. After I'd been up to see Paul and the guys and taken the fifth step, before I decided to... We decided to sell a house and cash in retirement and do all that. I'd seen a new pickup downtown and bought it. And Paul had come to town, my sponsor, and I went by to pick him up for breakfast or something. And we're driving to the restaurant. And he said, this nice truck. I said, thanks. He said, whose is it? I said, mine. He says, if it's your truck, you bought it with other people's money. You don't have money. Whose truck is it? And I understood. It wasn't my money to buy that truck. The hardest thing for me to catch in there doing that is that money I'm dealing with that whole time wasn't my money. It was theirs. And it needed to be getting back to them. Now, the fault I had coming into this spending thing and the paying the bills back and doing all that, as I kept thinking, well, I'm not going to have enough money to get along. I didn't have enough money to get along anyway because I didn't have any money. It was all somebody else's. Paul made that real clear, and I tried to tell that story because I felt so stupid when he said that to me. And I didn't need that truck. Just wanted it. I looked good in that truck, man. So anyway, I've said it before. My life in the 12 steps has saved my life, has saved my family. Julie and I are as closer now than we've ever been. I haven't strayed outside the marriage since that last time before I went up to see Paul with that first thing. I haven't done any of those things. Not that I haven't want to, haven't thought about it, but I haven't done it. We pray together in the morning sometimes. We sit together and don't pay much attention to what the other one is doing, but I may be meditating and probably reading, mostly planning my day. And often I'll take pad and pencil out like that, and after I've read the line in the book, it says we ask God to divorce our thinking from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. And then I'll write down the first thought that comes to my mind. That's been a pretty good thought, and it's worked out a lot more than it hasn't, in case you want to try it. I think today the best thing that we can all do in a place like this, and we leave here, is kind of just be glad. This thing's working for everybody in the room right now. And it will, as long as we're in touch with it, as we are right now. And we won't be. I mean, we're going to waver back and forth and get worse, get better, get great, and all that. But I've been allowed to be a part of life, been a part of this program, and had a life like you said last night, beyond anything I ever dreamed I would have. Well, I don't have the money I thought I was supposed to have. I thought when I moved to Indianapolis was to get rich. And I didn't get rich, but I'm richer than I ever dreamed. Doesn't have a thing to do with money. So all I know is this thing works, and it really does, and thanks for having me.